Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Joining me today is my girlfriend, Juliana. Say hello to everyone.
Hello.
And we're going to continue in our book club, in our reading of the Ian M. Banks Culture series. However, we are not reading it in the standard order, like what you'd say in the... in the chronological order that it was that the books are, the stories are, or even the order that it was written. I think actually that I think the books are written in chronological order within the culture, but we're doing our own reading order mainly, so we don't have to. We can start off with a good book and a good introduction to the culture, and end with a good book, and you know, kind of separate the books in the middle out a bit, so we don't have to worry too much about the order of them. We just have like a good through reading session, and so we started off with Player of Games because I thought that was a really good introduction to the culture, and it is one of the best books in the series. So you think, okay, this wasn't Ian M. Banks's first science fiction novel. You know, he'd done a few before then, or you know, he was a better writer then and kind of knew what he was doing. And then we can actually then switch back, which is the book number two in our reading order, which is Consider Phlebas, or Consider Phlebas. How do you think it's pronounced?
I don't know. I would say Phlebas.
Okay, Phlebas. We'll stick with Phlebas from now on. I actually just did a quick search on the internet to work out how do you pronounce Phlebas, and all of the results don't come up with anything except the mention of this book. You know, actually, you know, people. This is the most famous use of Phlebas, the word Phlebas, or of course the name as it appears in the Wasteland. The poem, or one of the poems in the Wasteland, or whatever it is. I don't know exactly how you'd consider it. But yeah, I couldn't find any pronunciation or pronunciation guides. So let's go with Phlebas. Phlebas?
Phlebas.
Phlebas. So yeah, not as good as Player of Games by any measure, I don't think.
No.
So what should we do? Should we talk a little bit about the setup for this book and a bit about the story, or what do you want to do? Or are you going to just presume that people are also reading along with this book club with series?
I saw on Goodreads that many people do that actually, and which I find quite nice to see other people putting out their reviews and their progress.
Yeah, you said all of your friends, who are obviously people who are SFBRP listeners who want to become your friends to read along with this, loads of them have either got it, they're either reading it, or they are also, you know, they've got it in their to-read thing. So it's good that people are reading along. That's pretty cool. So yeah, well, let's just talk a little bit about it. This is the first culture novel. It sets up the culture, but it talks about the culture from the opposite point of view, because our main viewpoint character is he's working for the enemy. There's a big kind of religiously inspired jihad-style expansion of a non-culture, of a big civilization, with these like semi-immortal war machines. Well, not war machines. They're not machines, actually. That's
no,
a bit. They're people. But like, if you were to see one, you're kind of like, yes, this species, the Edirans, are built for war. You know,
they're warriors.
Yeah, they're warriors. They've evolved over their entire existence, over millions of years, or thousands and thousands of years that their civilization has been around. They've evolved into a warrior culture, and now they're going, well, we need to bring the whole of the galaxy into order. That's what we're going to do. And they start doing it and start expanding, and the culture are like, oh, wait a moment there. And it's a strange thing, but anyway, there's a war going on, and the culture is on one side, and the culture is what normally the culture series is about. But here, it's told from the point of view of a shape changer, a shape shifter character called I was going to call him Gurge. It's not. It's Bora. What's his full name? Let's have a look. Bora Horza Gorbachev. Gorbachev. Again, we're gonna come
we're
up with our
talk
own...
about a bit about reading and pronouncing names throughout the book, because that's one thing that comes up.
Yeah,
I want to bring up later.
So anyway, he's on the side of the Edirans because he believes that life is the most important thing, and at this time the Edirans are on the side of biological life, and he thinks the culture is putting too much interest into, or putting too much faith in machines and machine intelligence in their minds and in their drones, and letting their future be controlled by stuff. So on the broad overview, that's what it is. And this story...
It's about biological life forms against...
Yes, on the surface of it,
machines and drones.
Yes, on the surface of it, that's what the if we were to put it as a black and white conflict, it would be machines.
The general thing.
Yeah. So anyway, so this shapeshifter is employed by the Edirans to infiltrate culture, or infiltrate more human-looking civilizations and governments and stuff. That's where we meet him at the beginning. He's working for the Edirans,
which is really handy if you're a spy and you can you can change your appearance to every species you.
Let me bring this up in a second. Just to finish it, we'll come back to that, because that's an important point from some feedback that we got from the last culture book club episode that we did. Anyway, he does this, and a ship's mind is almost blown up and escapes and lands on this planet, which is held by this what was it called, Char's World, which is there's this like godlike the Drazen, this godlike mind kind of, well, not mind again, I don't want to say mind, because it's difficult to say that it's a mind, because a mind is a specific thing within the culture, but yeah, this godlike being is keeping this planet as like a museum planet, Bora Horza Gorbachev used to work on that planet, and the Edirans are like, hey, you go down there and get the ship's mind so we can find out how ship's minds work and we can win this war a lot more easily. And the culture are like, hey, we need to get someone down there to find this mind so so we can win this war a bit less difficultly. So the story is pretty much about this changer trying to get to this planet and trying to find this mind while going on adventures, and while the culture is trying to stop him. So that's the broad overview of the story. Shape-shifting man goes to get MacGuffin. That's what it is. And the ship's mind is the MacGuffin. So should we start with
whatever
some questions?
That is, I don't even know.
MacGuffin. Oh, it's a thing which I think it was Hitchcock first came up with the idea. He said the MacGuffin is the thing that people want, and it doesn't really matter what they want. It's normally a briefcase of money or a briefcase with documents in it.
It's like a made-up word for something.
Yeah, the MacGuffin is the thing that people want in a story and will do stuff to get.
Okay.
You know, if you've seen any of these, gangster movies, or it's about the suitcase of money, and it doesn't have to be money. It can be secret documents. Even like the jokes are played with this. If you've seen them, Pulp Fiction, is it Pulp Fiction? There's a suitcase there, but also I think it's in Reservoir Dogs. They open the suitcase, and all that comes out of the suitcase is a glowing light, and then they go, yep, that's it, and close it. So the viewer never knows what's in the suitcase.
I think it's in Pulp Fiction.
But I think it's a similar kind of thing in the Reservoir Dogs, you know. So it's the same kind of thing. Open it up, that's the MacGuffin, just the thing that he wants to get. And in this, the thing that he wants to get is kind of important, thematically, but it is one of those things, right? You're on a quest, get this thing to solve the problem, whatever. So let me just go back to the shape-shifting thing. Last time out, we were talking about what people look like, what culture people look like, and we were saying about Gurge, or however you pronounce his name, and what he looks like, and you imagined him as just a normal white person, and someone actually was talking on the Goodreads, the SFBRP listener group on goodreads.com, which you can follow along with this reading group on there if you want. And he says, in mine, Juliana's defense, well, actually, I didn't write down the name. It could have been a he or a she or whatever. Again, my 1989 copy of the Player of Games has what looks like a tall white man surveying a game board on the cover. Anyway, it's a fascinating discussion about how we envisage characters in books. I've read the whole culture series, but I must confess I automatically picture the protagonist as normal-looking white people unless I'm hit over the head with the description. I think it's natural. Wrong assumption. And this is what you want to talk about now as well. Like, I mean, this is also what I want to talk about. Like, because you said you had the same kind of thing.
I think it's natural. I was brought up in a society where all around me were white people, And
so you default to white person in your brain.
I can't even do anything against it.
Yes.
It's just like if I would have been brought up somewhere else, I would maybe not be
of course
like
you wouldn't
this.
Be. Yeah.
And
so you see depictions of Jesus, you know, Jesus in
I don't care about Jesus.
No, but I'm saying like when you say depictions of Jesus, like when people think about Jesus, like in America, Jesus is like the most white American looking person ever. And when you see depictions of Jesus in other cultures, he always takes on exactly what they'd be like. That's why you get black Jesus.
He's a symbol. He's a representative of the society.
Exactly. But
and of
people
course,
then project.
In my mind, Jesus can't be white because he lived somewhere where they're not really white people.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Depictions, more, not in your brain. Yeah.
Anyway, so, but also when I read a book, it's what happens if I get really sucked into the book? It's that I'm not reading word by word, sentence by sentence. I read a picture.
Yeah.
And then I read across the page, and it's so quick. Luke sometimes say, oh, how can you read so quickly, especially in German?
Yeah.
But then I have a movie going on in my head. And
the words that you come across just update the picture
exactly,
as it's happening.
Yeah, it's just like, it's more like a script, and so there's a movie going on. So every person looks somehow. I can't even do anything against it. Like even if I watched a movie, the person, if I read the book beforehand, the person in my head looks like I imagined the person beforehand.
Yeah.
And so I can't even say, okay, now I have to imagine Gergi. Now I know he's some kind of
he's got dark
brown,
skin.
Dark
yeah.
skin. It was really difficult at that point to then switch my imagination of the character I imagined before into that like now up-to-date picture that I got later in the book.
Well, I think I have a completely different reading experience for the most part, in that I have like stand-in shapes and images which aren't human. Like I don't have that same kind of, when I'm reading a book, I don't have the pictures playing out in my head. In like, I don't imagine, I know it's a weird thing, maybe it's like a lack of imagination or a more controlled imagination or a different style of imagination, but when I'm reading, I don't picture people talking to each other. I kind of put aside what the people look like in my head, and it's just two sides of a conversation. And I think this is actually why I enjoy some fiction a lot and other fiction not enough. There has to be a good balance between description and non-description, if you know what I mean. But when there isn't description, I don't fill in those facts in my brain. I have these like amorphous blobs of people, and when I don't imagine them as real people with real faces. Like if you say, does he have a beard or not, I'm like, I don't know if he has a beard or not, unless it's mentioned, you know. And as the details come along, it kind of fills in these details in my mind. And I've noticed this a lot, like especially when, if I'm listening to the radio, if you're listening to the radio, do you imagine each person's voice, like do you imagine somebody talking when you're listening to the radio? Because I don't. I just imagine, like,
that's
you know,
difficult.
Like I have like a, you know, these white plastic masks that you see, like these drama masks, like I, you know, I have in my act that I was doing with the book. Like that's what I imagine. And when I started listening to podcasts, this happened time and time again that I would never actually imagine what the person's face looked like. And now I almost go out of my way not to see pictures of people who I know as a podcast, because I've never thought of their face. When they say something and they're happy, I never think of somebody's face, like pictures a whole face and that person smiling. I just picture a smile.
I actually do.
Well,
because
I think that's a
like,
big difference.
It's very often that voices of people remind me of people that I know or where I have faces in my head.
Yeah.
And immediately there's a face projected to it.
Yeah.
And what you just said about when they have conversations and it's just a conversation without description, that is actually something that really not annoys me in books, but like especially in Consider Flubbers, there was like certain points where you just where you just had a conversation, it was going on, you weren't really sure if there were more than one person talking, and then you weren't sure who is talking, and I couldn't imagine a thing to it, and then I had to read like a description where somebody said something, And it was super boring for me because I couldn't see, like...
Okay, let's bring this up. There's one point when someone, the eye, I can't remember his name, something the eye. Can you search for that? The reporter, there was a...
Oh, it's the damage.
No, yeah, it was the game of damage. Is it? Is
game
it,
of damage.
Damage. You go, yeah, it's the game
starts,
of damage. Yeah, it
starts
off, the chapter 7 starts off with this long monologue and you don't know who's talking about it. Sarble the Eye. And it just fins like, I'll be filing another report again sometime during the course of the game from within the auditorium if I can get in there. But in the meantime, goodbye and take care. And this is like 4 pages into this chapter and you don't know who has been
so
taken.
Annoying.
And you were really annoyed by that. But for me, I'm just like, okay, somebody's talking. I never once pictured what this person is, and he goes, this is Sarble the Eye, Evernouth City, Vavach Orbital. Oh, they don't say Vavach, but it's Vavach, like that. And like, it goes, the image of the man on the wrist screen standing in the sunlight on the plaza faded, the half masked youngish face disappearing. And of course, we find out that Sarble the Eye isn't one person, it could that he meets two people who are both Sarble the Eye. One is a woman and one is... And you realise that what you thought was it's just this image of a man standing in sunlight on the plaza faded. You know, the half-masked youngest face disappearing. I was, like, you kind of... When I do this, I'm kind of clued in that the next time that character comes back up, it might not be a masked face. It might not be a man. You know, if you know what I mean? Because all of that time, I haven't been picturing a face in my mind.
I think
and it could have been a constructed face, you know, like the standing in sunlight on a plaza fade. You know, all I get is that faded stuff. And then when a character turns up later, of course, I've read this book. This is like the third time I've read this book. So I knew who, you know, when this other character turns up, I was like, oh yeah, that's Sarble the Eye. I remember how this goes. And it plays into the plot a bit later of this identity. But this fluid identity is what Ian and Banks is really interested in. And that's the reason why his main character is a changer. And you're like, well, how do I know what he looks like? But we never know what he looks like. At the beginning,
his own look.
Yeah, we don't know. He's an old man. And then he goes, well, now I'm going to change. Like, I'm going to say what I, you know, I'm going to now pretend to change into myself. But actually what I'm doing is I'm going to be as close to the captain. What was it? What was the captain?
Craiglin.
Yeah, Craiglin. I'm going to change to as close to Captain Craiglin as possible, but still be a little bit different. And then when he changes into Craiglin, then he's like, oh, but now I'm going to go back a bit to my former self. So when I meet this person who I used to know, that I want her to recognize me. So I've got to be able to quickly change into this other person for her to recognize me. So that whole idea of having this, like in the way that I read this blob figure is... It kind of works. It kind of plays into the strengths of his writing. There's another chapter that we were just on before, which is where the command system, is it engines or something like that, where another character does a really long monologue at the beginning. You're like, well, what are we reading here? And I'm like, oh, it's Skylar. And you find out that you're actually reading it from the... I mean, it only takes one page to work out who's actually talking there or what's going on. And then there's another character, Balveda, what's her name? Peristek Balveda, who is the culture agent, the special circumstances agent. She comes in, and when she turns up again, she's also changed. Because culture people can change their looks really easily and quickly as well. You know, like they've kind of supplanted the changes, the shape changes, with their skills. You know, they're at that level. And so when he sees her, like when... Horser sees her for the first time, well, not for the first time, but when she comes and joins up on the ship, he thinks, I wouldn't have recognized you compared to what you looked like before, but I do because I'm a changer and I can recognize people without even knowing what their faces are, you know, just by the walk or just by the look.
She just been like aging.
She changed her look completely.
Okay.
She thought she would be able to fool Horser, but Horser was like, no, I can see through you. And he recognized her immediately, but he acknowledges that if he wasn't a changer, he wouldn't have recognized her immediately.
Yeah.
And she also recognized him immediately, despite having a completely different face and looking exactly like the captain. Of course, she didn't know already because the fly didn't send her anything.
Yeah,
so, but she still recognized him immediately, and they both knew that they were both in trouble straight away.
Yes.
So again, I think it's interesting that we, after talking about how we view characters, this book is about almost how we view characters.
Yeah, and I think this book is really suits your style of reading. Mm. Because some of these chapters were so difficult for me to
well, let's go through, ask your questions, because you said you had some questions about what you wanted to, some different points that you want to ask about.
First of all, there is this woman. Now I don't. I need to.
Where were your notes?
I need to go. I don't have notes.
you do have notes.
At the end, there is this dramatis personae. Personae. And so here she is. Her name is Staffel Prions.
Fal
Gestra. Fildon Gestra Dumcruz. Whatever.
Yeah, she's got a long culture name.
So, what is her purpose in this book? What is she doing there? She's like this. She's like this side character, and she's like in like at a certain point, there's this drone coming towards her and saying, "Oh, I have a job for you to do." And I was the whole time waiting for her to appear somewhere in the story.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that kind of falls flat. I thought she was a really interesting character.
Yeah, like, by what she what she did.
Yeah,
but she didn't take part in the story.
She did. She kind of influenced. She sent the character, and she has this long like monologue to herself of like, "Oh, I sent this person here, but I'm not in any danger here in the culture. But you know, this person over here is in danger, but I'm sending them into danger. You know, it's sort of like I'm casting their lives." Yeah, I think like I would be really interested just to read a short story about this character. I don't think she adds a huge amount to this book. What she does do, though, is. I know it's a weird thing, but there's this, the whole book is, like I say, on the surface of it is about, oh, machines running everything bad, life running things good. And she, it kind of explains what her job is, that, like, every, you know, out of every trillion, or out of every how many billion people there are, there'll be one or two who can look at a situation and intuitively, like, kind of deduce or induce, or no, whatever it is, yeah, so to kind of work out what is going on. And she's like, ah, they're going to look for the mind, they're going to send this guy, they're going to do that. And even the ship's minds are like, really? Why do you think that? And she's just like, I think so. But what she is like a little bit of like organic matter that is kind of like in a world, like in the culture, which is completely run by machines and by minds and by ships and drones and all technology. She's like a little last outcrop or last little pocket of humanity somewhere controlling the ships. Does that make sense? Like, she is written into it as like, if this book was purely the machines on one side, like machines on one side, artificial intelligence, or whatever you want to call them, minds on one side, and on the other side is life and the adherence. It would be a bit too flat, a bit too cut and dry. And then at the end of the book, in that book, we discover that she is a little bit of like biological humanity, which is actually more in control and can recognize things more in control than the machines. And also we realise at the end of the book that the adherents have had computers and machines helping them all along, but they have been artificially kept non-sentient. And as soon as their machines, it's one of the epilogues at the end, it's like, as soon as one of my... You did make a note about that. You know, the planet of Idia was never attacked, technically never surrendered. Its computer network was taken over by effective weapons and freed of designed-in limitations, upgraded itself to sentience to become a culture mind in all but name. And this is like the opposite side of that you think, oh, the Idirans, they were always just using life and using their own brains. No, they were using computer minds all the time.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Do you understand what I'm saying? There's two sides.
You mean the Fel... I forgot her name.
Just call it Fel.
Fel. She is like the human side of the culture.
Yes. She represents humanity in a leadership position within the culture, even though I don't think that role is ever really kind of reprised or that idea is really reprised in other culture, because really the minds are far more powerful than humans. That a human, I can't even imagine, like I say, I think this is a misstep by Ian M. Banks to write this character into the novel in such a remove like that, because it felt almost like an afterthought. You know, if it was just actually the minds are really intelligent and they're going to know that they're going to look for that person, they're going to connect here and the Adirans are going to do this and going to do that, and they don't need to rely on humanity. Sure, it makes the whole setup slightly less complex, but this kind of messes up the view of the culture and kind of messes up the novel by introducing this character. I'd rather it been like, you know, her as a separate side story or like a short story.
Or she just be more involved in it. And all the time I was thinking, oh, maybe there's a twist. Maybe there's a twist. And she's like, whatever. She comes into the story at some point.
But it even says she's too far away.
Influencing. Somehow taking part. All she does is this weird... I thought at some point there was a connection between her and Horza when they had, she was in a trance.
Yeah, she kind of goes...
She was like on top of the mountain or in the boat or whatever.
Yeah, she was having visions. She
has in this trance thing and then she was thinking, this is the italic writing bit, what was also a bit annoying for me. And then I thought... she and Horza were some kind of mix, and then I thought, oh, maybe she is Horza, and Horza, because he's a changer, don't remember that he's...
I thought
it would be some...
You thought
clever,
it was going to be better.
Yeah.
In the end, I think he's trying to be clever, but I think as a writing exercise or as a part of the novel, I think it falls a bit flat. Anyway, what's another question you've got? Like, you have lots of notes there. Yeah. Or not loads, highlights in the book of stuff that
I
you
have... Some words which I found really funny. For example, the word biotomaton. What's that?
What's that?
Biotomaton. Can you sleep?
It's like an automation. It's like an automaton. An automaton is like a machine which just does its own thing. Like,
is it like Terminator?
Well, yeah, it's more of like a wind-up thing. You wind it up and you get it and it just does its thing automatically over and over again. And I guess a bioautomaton is a biological automaton.
Whenever I read this word, and I think it appears several times.
But isn't that what the Edirans call... Yes, they look at humans and just say, wow, you're not as intelligent as us.
Yeah.
But that's actually the thing that I actually really liked about this, is that the Edirans, you think, wow, these guys must be like to go up against the culture and win against the culture. And it says that they're adults, like these long-lived adults, are way more intelligent than the humans and way more hardy than the humans. And you think, well, how are you going to write that? But then when they actually get to that point, Horza and the other people are going up against these guys at the end. Yeah. They just get their asses kicked by like two Edirans, like, and one of them's half dead, sure. And the other one's like that.
Yeah.
And they're just totally.
They're super powerful.
They're super powerful and really clever. And it's just like, oh, and this guy pretends to be, he's like spitting blood, and you think, and we're going, wait a second, is he really ill?
Yeah,
or is he
like
that?
It was,
and it's just
obvious.
Like, oh yeah, and my mouth hurt because I needed to spit blood, so you thought I was internally damaged, you know, and.
But what I was actually going for with the biotomaton is that whenever I read this word, I had to giggle a bit because it sounds so much like biotomatoes.
Yeah, organic tomatoes.
Organic tomatoes. And in German, all organic stuff is called bio.
Yeah.
So whenever I read this word, and it appears several times, I had to like...
Yes, it is almost exactly... It is
biotomatoes.
Anyway, you've got another question. I don't want to take too long on
And there was word. Another one where I killed when it's the mercenaries were introduced, and they called KFC.
Yeah, the Craiglin's Free Company.
I think this is some kind of little joke that he puts in there.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like the Clear Air Turbulence, the ship is always called the Cat. Yeah, so it's the Cat and the KFC.
These little things are a bit like what he puts into. Also, when he names the ships and stuff.
Let's talk a little bit about the humor in this book, because I think there's a lot. Like the, let me put it this way: in the other culture books, ones written after this, are a lot more funny on the face of it. This has got quite a lot of irony in it and stuff like that. But there is like less broader humor. I know it's a bit weird to say that, but broad humor. But this is quite dour compared to other books. Even like a book which is really quite heavy going, like Use of Weapons, all the time. You've got the comic. I wouldn't say comic relief, but the lighter relief of the ship's minds, and especially the drones and the culture agents. You know, you like in Use of Weapons, you keep going back to. I can't remember the names of that, Zietzma, and the I can't remember the name of the because all the names in these books are really weird. But you keep going back to these guys, and I think what we actually have here in Consider Flevis is it's him working out what's really good about the culture novels. For example, it starts off when you spend time with Hozo and you're like, oh man, this guy doesn't make any jokes, and you meet this person and there's not a lot going on there as well. And then, like, part of the way through the book, he meets a ship's mind for the first time, and it's this really very baseline sentient ex-culture
shuttle
craft. And suddenly you're just pissing yourself laughing because it's really, really funny. And it's like he was writing this book and then for the first time wrote what it was actually like to interact with a ship's mind.
Yeah.
And so we see that.
So nice.
And then
I got so angry.
Yeah, but...
Wait, don't spoil it.
No, it doesn't matter.
I got angry and I really enjoyed this little shuttle mind.
But then what happens is that there's like one of the people stranded, once they leave the orbital, one of the people stranded on the ship is a drone. He's not a culture mind. He's not a culture drone, but he's a drone. And as soon as he's there, like, everything that he says is really funny. Is like all the interactions that he has, I'm just grinning, like straight away grinning on my face. And then when the culture agent, Peristock, whatever her name is it Peristock? Peristock Belveda, when she turns up and all of her interactions are really good. And then when we get to the Edirans at the end, like all of the stuff that the Edirans are saying and all of the interactions there, they were also really good fun. And I realized what I actually, like all of the lightness in the book, all of the really interesting stuff from the book came from not the culture. It's like the culture and their enemies. And these other characters that we had, like Yalson and Hauser and Craiglin.
The mercenaries in general.
And all the mercenaries in general. Just not very interesting. I mean, interesting in some ways to spend time with, but a lot of it was just like, wow.
Quite heavy.
It's just heavy, yeah. And not a lot of fun. And yeah. As soon as the stuff turns up, and I made a note here. Let me see if I can just find my note.
Okay, when you find your note, I have a really funny quote from one of the drones, and I want to read that out because that's super funny. Jace, what's one of the drones, and he's like a... quite an old manufactured one.
Yeah, but he's the one who looks after Fal, isn't he?
Yeah, and he has not these how do you call them, the spheres around
the
him.
The effector fields.
Yeah, the effect. He doesn't have that. But then it says, Jays, which deep down was a hopeless romantic, thought her laughter sounded like the tingling of mountain streams and always recorded her laughs for itself, even when there were snorts or... Guffaws.
Like a...
Even when she was being rude and it was a dirty laugh. Isn't that cute?
Yeah, he records all of her laughter to play back for himself later.
That is so cute. I mean, how, like, just have in mind it's a drone, it's a machine. And then he's like, he's described to be deeply romantic.
And that's what I'm saying. The drones and the drones are the representatives of the culture in this way. It says that in the Player of Games that they said, you know, like, who was the most important person going there? Was it the biological human or was it the drone? Was it Imsa Flop or whatever his name is, or was it Gerge? And the case could be made that the real protagonist, well, not the real protagonist, but the real thing going to the Azad Empire in Player of Games, the one who actually got stuff done, like, Player of Games... It came down to it that it was actually the drone versus the Azad Empire, and Gerge was just a playing piece.
Yes,
that's what we were talking about last time.
But
here, this is something I highlighted here. It says, indeed, a case could be made for holding that the culture was its machines, that they represented it at a more fundamental level than did any single human or group of humans within the society. And what I'm going to say is, indeed, the case could be made for holding that the culture novels are defined by its machines and that they represent it in a more fundamental level than does any single human character or group of human characters within the culture series and its books. It's not entirely true, but I think a case could be made for that. And this book really demonstrated that Ian and Banks didn't know what he was doing with the culture yet. He didn't realise that what people actually want from culture novels is machines interacting with humans. Yeah. Is the culture interacting with machines?
I think the thing what makes the machines so interesting is that they are not only like robots doing what they're meant to do, but they it is the combination of the human consciousness and the mind like they do.
Conscious mind?
Yeah, whatever. And being very clever and a drone at the same time. It's this combination and they are all really funny. And
it's not that they're just really funny. It's just that the exploration of what the drones are like and in some ways the ship minds, but the ship minds are like unknowable because they're way more advanced than us.
Yeah.
And the human culture people are kind of like, they're not all the same, but they're all kind of cosseted and stuff. But it's like in this, what's really fun is reading about the non-culture drone trying to insist that he is a real person, like all the time. It's just like, no, don't
have a name.
Use my name. Use the thing. And that's one of the most fun like character arcs in this book is how Horza comes to rely on this drone, even as he's saying, "I'm fighting this war and I'm trying to get this MacGuffin, this mind to defeat the thing that would make you equal." In that kind of, do you understand what I'm saying? It is that drone. So, okay, I think we should move on. We don't want to spend.
But it's funny because all the time we're talking about the drone and the drone. The problem are the names.
Yeah, we can't remember the names.
Can't remember the names because the names are always like.
But it's there's a reason why when we get to the very end of it, to sort of like this is what the characters did after this book. You know, the drone that we had before, he gets like a full story, and I wouldn't say he's a hero by the end of it. But
he is.
But it's really we sign off with him. You know, what's his name? Oh no, it's Unaha Klosp. Was his name, and it said at the end, he retired now, and he builds small steam-driven automata as a hobby, you know.
Oh, that's so sweet!
So he's a machine that builds other machines as a hobby, but steam-driven ones, and you're like, well, why steam? You know, it's a funny idea after all the time wanting to be not classed as a machine and trying to acknowledge himself as a real person, that he... Then, yeah, it's funny. I'm just saying it's funny that then he makes machines as a hobby once he retires. Yes. It's a very clever little thing.
And as I said beforehand, the name thing is so funny because when I highlighted one bit here, and whenever I, like, he introduces the characters and they all have these...
Long names.
Long, weird names. And when I read through and I don't have to talk about it, I literally just need...
It's just it's a place.
So that is in my head. There is this word, and I just read it. I don't even read it. So
I think that's a common thing. Actually.
And I have to force Ishlosinami. I have to actually force myself to read the single letters, and then put it together in some kind of name. Yep. But I forget it straight away.
So you just see the
Ishlum.
Yeah.
And that's enough.
That happens enough. Like, people reading a book, they're like, oh, I've never actually said that word out loud. You know, it happens time and time again.
Oh, I mixed up the letters all the time, and in my head it was not Berveda, it was Bavelda or whatever.
Well, that's what I realized it was only when I read this book again, it was like, oh, they're called Idirans, because I remember in the last podcast I was calling them Idrians. And I managed to just switch around two letters in my head because it's been so long. Well, maybe not so long since I read it, but like it's only now when I actually, because it came up time and time again, they're from Idir, and they're Idirans and that kind of stuff. Whereas before, when like in the previous book, like Play of Games, it just meant, oh yeah, he was a leftover from the Idrian War. Although it didn't say that, but that's how I read it kind of just misremembering what the name was. Okay, really another question. You got another question. More notes here. I think we should get through these. Otherwise, I'll finish off with talking a bit more about the writing and what I didn't like about this novel.
I think that was mostly what I had to say about it. I still don't know how to rate it.
Yeah.
But
I got another here. There's more games in this book. There's a game called...
My mum's making coffee now, so
it might be
some background noise.
Okay, so there's a game that they play called Damage, and we get this really long description of Damage, and these Damage players come in, and this Damage player does this, and this different... And you realise that, of course, we know this already, that Ian M. Banks is obviously, as he's writing, he's very He's got a lot of ideas about games, you know, and this is a game and he does this. And there's even, oh, he was a game player who came here. And then there was this, there's a group of players called the game group called the Players on the Eve of Destruction. And he does this whole thing. And there's games where there's like, that you have lives, and if someone loses a life, somebody loses a life, you know, actually somebody dies, and all this kind of stuff. And you read that and you're like, this is really interesting. It kind of just takes up a long time in the middle of the book and doesn't add very much to this book. And as I was reading it, I was like thinking, well, wouldn't it be great if just like a really cool game like this, which has got like lots of life and death, wouldn't it be great if there was like a whole novel told about, of course there is, it's Player of Games. But again, it's one of those things where you go, consider Phlebas is Izzy Inman Banks working out what later books should include. And you're like, okay, let's take this idea of this. Like, we'll take an idea of a culture agent going somewhere and doing something. We'll take something about this, like an alien, and do this. And there's lots of ideas in this book, which, to be honest, I don't think fit together very well as a novel. But you understand why they're all...
It feels very much like several parts stick together.
Yes.
And actually, in my head, because I wanted to finish the book, and I started reading last night at like maybe like 12 o'clock or something.
Yeah.
And I wanted to finish it, so I read till 3 o'clock in the morning. And then I thought, well, now that was starting a new chapter. It was chapter 14, which is three pages. And I stopped there, not knowing that it's only 3 pages long. And I had to read through it. I was so attached by the story, and it got up so quick, and the pace was really high, and something happened.
But only in that last third of the book.
Yeah.
What happens is that at the beginning of the book, it's really interesting. You're like, oh yeah, there's this and there's that going on. He comes in and he has to fight for his place, and here, yeah, it's great. And then they go off on this mission here, and stuff. Lots of people die, and they go on another mission here to a boat, and lots of people die, and then he gets captured by the cannibals, and people, and then people die, and
why
stuff
is
like
that.
And then he gets captured by he gets captured here and rescued there, and then he gets rescued again with this, and then he flies here, and then he does this, and then he gets. And there is just a huge amount of the middle of this book, which is nothing but filling in like the wider world. It's like, this is what an orbital is, yes, and this is what people do on an orbital. This is this game that he goes to play in, and then he goes back here and he meets these other people and does this other stuff, and he meets these people and they try and kill him, and these people don't try and kill him, and these people he kills, and it just feels, and all of it's info dumping. It's all like, and now let me tell you about the history of this.
Yeah.
And now let me take, and it just doesn't fit together into a novel. And it's like, and again. It's just not very good compared to a lot of his other stories. It's like...
Yeah,
like
it's very constructed. Like, it's very put together.
Now, what it does do is make you think... And again, it comes back to what this book sets up for later. But it's like, wow, wouldn't it be really cool to know more about these orbitals? And, like, can we have something there? And then you get a bit in Player of Games about the orbital. Like, you know, and how they build it. She says, oh, yeah, I'm building this plate of the orbital, and we're going to get two of them, and they kind of swing around, and then they fix them together. We're going to put a volcano in it, and here is a bit. So we do get that. And then also Look to Windward, which is going to be the last book we do in this book club. That's all of the action happens there with an orbital, and talking a lot more with the orbital's mind. But all of the stuff that happens in this book doesn't really, like, all of the orbital stuff, like, did we need to go there? Like, why couldn't it be, like, he gets onto the Clear Air Turbulence, they start going towards one place, and then while he's on the ship, he replaces the guy, and then they arrive, you know, it doesn't need to be, maybe one stop along the way, rather than five stops along the way, because they stop on the planet.
Yeah, and then there's this Temple of Light.
The Temple of Light, again, that just, all it does is reduce the number of people. All of this stuff could have been put together in one stop. They go towards, and they stop at the damage game. And during the damage game, like, they get the new crew members, they get the culture agent back on, they get this back on. You know, it could have been streamlined in that way. It's a lot of stuff which hasn't got any impact to the story. Yeah, thematically it can play in. They've got the stuff with the religion, and like, oh, this is a really like weird religion where they eat themselves, and that's like kind of plays into what the Edirans, because they're on a religious crusade, but he's on the side of one religious crusade, which is, yes, life is good, and then he sees these people who have rejected technology and they're living on an island and all they want is life, and it's life to the excess, to the point where they're eating life and then eating what life shits out in. It's just this whole weird thing, and you go, right, yeah, I understand what you're trying to do there, Mr. Banks. But it doesn't do anything for the character. It doesn't do anything for the story. It doesn't do anything for the telling of the story. It doesn't do anything for the plot. Unlike, say, Player of Games, where every single little detail, all of the world building that we find out about, plays back in to the character, plays back in to what that person's story is, and everything in that kind of plays back into this dynamic between the culture and this opposite civilization, which is the Azad Empire. And the next episode that we're going to record, probably tomorrow, whenever we're going to do it, because we just finished this book yesterday, is The Prefect by Alistair Reynolds. And Alistair Reynolds is one of my favorite authors. And just to compare these two books, The Prefect, which one of my main complaints about that book when I reviewed it earlier on in the podcast, back in episode 19 or 21 or whatever it was, like a long time ago, back in 2008 when I read it for the first time, one of my complaints was that everything is too tied up. There's not a single detail about anything which is ever mentioned which doesn't somehow have something to do with the plot, even to the point where, and when it came up when we were listening to the audiobook, Yulia and I together, like one character, something that happened to her father, which we thought was just an interesting background character, which informs her character that she's got to push through and her father was disgraced and all that kind of stuff. And you think, oh, that's just a nice little bit of background. Turns out that is directly influenced by the main plot of the novel as well, or some of the main conspiracies, and it all ties in together. And in a way, it makes the world feel smaller. Is that my tea, do you think?
That's your tea.
Okay, pass over the tea and cake. We'll have that as soon as we finish it. So what it does is that by making everything...
Whoa, it's hot.
Yes, but you passed it directly over my laptop there. So it makes... by making everything in the world revolve around a single plot or a single incident or a single character or a single conspiracy or a single thing, it actually shrinks the world down. So nothing outside of the story exists in the world. There is nothing in the world which exists outside of this story, this plot, this character, this conspiracy. Whereas in the Culture series, and especially this book itself, like, very little in the book has to do with this story, this character, this incident, this thing. Like, loads of stuff is on the periphery, but we find out lots about the periphery, which is bad, I think, for storytelling, but great for world building. It makes the world feel very, very vibrant, very, very lived in. And it's a balance that has to be struck between info dumps, which turns out every single thing that's mentioned has to do with the story, and info dumps, which turns out nothing has to do with the story.
And it's Play of Games, the balance is way better there. And there's not so many paragraphs where I was sitting, I will have to go through, I will read.
It gets boring.
At some points, like, I really had to force myself not to skip like paragraphs, just because of this. And now more background story, and it's like, oh, come on, what's the story, going to happen?
But there's all of this kind of stuff where it goes, I saw a note here, he had 3/10 of an Aeorish credit, and it's like, and now the history of Aeorish credits, and Aeorish credits, and the Aeorish people are this banking thing, and you have this thing, and there's like a holographic thing which can be returned for any amount of metal or land on a free orbital, and all this, and you're just going, wow, that's it. And what's that used for? He just needs to get in somewhere, so he used it. And it's used as a currency and damage, and some people do that. You're like, oh, that's really great. How's that going to help us out by the end of this? Turns out, not at all. The Aeorish credits never come back into it again. They don't have anything to do with the story. The only thing that they are is a little bit. And you realise it's useless, because I can't remember any other culture novel where money is mentioned at all, because guess what?
In the culture, there's no money.
There's no money. And when he goes to Azad, how much money is it worth? It's mentioned that, you know, what you're doing, that drink is worth like somebody's yearly.
Yeah, he doesn't understand it.
And he goes, what? Money? Like that. But here it's like there's culture on one side, the Edirans on the other side, plus lots of other stuff going on. Is the Vavach orbital, that wasn't built by the culture. It was built by a previous thing that wasn't culture, because I think it's, you know, it's called a free orbital, so it's not a culture orbital, but it isn't, you know. And there's all of these different things mentioned, and you realise not much of it has anything to do with the story or the characters. They're just, like, why did we have to read a big info dump about Aeorish credits?
And then at the end of the book...
Yeah.
I might have even wanted to read that at the beginning of the book, because it made several things clear. When you have these other, like, chapters, which are like the appendices, the about the war, about the culture, about the adherence, about all the characters and stuff, I might have wanted that at the beginning.
Yeah,
because I mean, it gives good, some good background info. But...
yeah, but it kind of, but it wouldn't have been good to. I don't think it is good to read that at the beginning, and also yeah. it's kind of bad to read it at the end. This is another thing. It goes first of all, it says the war briefly. The first Iderian culture dispute occurred in AD 1267. You realise, and I'd forgotten about this when I was saying, you know, I was mentioning other people's reading orders where they said, oh, start off with. Start off with state of the art. And I was like, no, don't start off with that, because that centers on the earth and about the culture's influence or contact with the earth, with our human earth. And I said, no, you've got to read the book as though you don't know if this book isn't part of the earth's our far, far future. And it isn't. It's not in a distant galaxy a long time ago. It's not in our galaxy a long time away in the future. It's actually just happening now. You know, the culture is happening now, as we find out. And when you actually read it here, the war briefly, and then it gives it in human, like earth, what, Gregorian calendar, no, what is it, like AD, BC, AD, and it kind of then diminishes it in a way.
I was wondering, maybe it's not our AD.
No, it is.
Maybe it's their.
No, it isn't. It's, I think it even says somewhere, but it isn't. These are actually the real dates, our
because
dates,
they have a god. They have like a.
No, it isn't. It's AD and BC. This is it, so I forgot about that. But then what you're saying is like, should you have read this first? No, I don't think so, because it kind of then, what I was saying before about making the world larger and smaller by including these details, statistics, length of war, 48 years, and then it goes through here, losses, ships, like 91 million ships were lost. And then it goes, orbitals, 14,334 orbitals were lost. Do you know what the orbital is? The orbital is Vavach orbital. And we thought, reading this book, that losing this orbital was this massive... was like a massive big thing. It was a massive loss that this orbital, which is, you know, thousands of miles across and, you know, millions of kilometers are all the way around. And it's this massive thing. And the people, when it was going up, and they say, oh, it's a new height, that they're just going to blow up this orbital just because they can't have it anymore. And if we can't have it anymore, you can't have it anymore. It was meant to be neutral. It wasn't neutral. And it seemed like at the time a massive sacrifice or a massive gesture or a massive thing. And they're only 4 years into the war, and the war lasts, what, 48 years. But by the end of it, 14,334 of them are going to be destroyed. So then it kind of belittles that sacrifice. You know, these statistics, 851 billion people died.
Plus or minus
3%. It's like a comics that it feels a bit like, you know, a bit like a, you know, saying like within the... Slaughterhouse 5 by Kurt Vonnegut, and it's like every time death is mentioned, it's like, oh, and so it goes. This feels like a big, oh, so it goes. It's like, oh, and there was this war, you know, 851 billion people died, and what you thought was impressive with this Ravach orbital going up turns out not. Or was that a ring? No, I think it was the orbital, wasn't it? I guess a ring is meant to be like a ring world which goes around, it's so big it goes around. Yeah. I'm not sure, but like, it, you know, and three stars going, it kind of. And then it says, historical perspective, a small, short war that rarely extended throughout more than 0.2% of the galaxy. So, again, he goes through all this thing, and in some ways he makes the world really big and lived in, and yet by these two little paragraphs at the end of, you know, the war in brief, or whatever, briefly the war, whatever the name of it, he goes, historical perspective, yeah, Iderian culture war, not seen as that important. So it suddenly shrinks down everything that's happened into the book and kind of belittles it in a way, which I think does the book disservice. So I would actually suggest, if you read this book, isn't, you know, you can stop, read the thing, but like the whole description of the war, if you were to read that description of the war and it goes, oh, it only extended throughout 0.2% of the galaxy, you know, and only 0.01 of the stellar populations, you know, were involved in it. Again, it feels little again.
Yeah.
And that goes against the book. And I do think it's some of these just basic but small steps in the writing and small bits and pieces here kind of ruin the book for me, or ruin the enjoyment for me of this book.
I wouldn't say ruin.
No, but it sets, like, everything. There's so much stuff which is good in this book, but then at every turn, like at these certain turns, it just goes, actually that bit didn't matter. Oh, no, that didn't matter either. And I'd really want to stay with a bit more of the higher level stuff. So another, I did make a few more notes here. Let me just go through the final notes. Just quite a bit of the, just clumsy writing, you know, at some points. I just thought, well, he certainly got better as a writer as he went through, these culture novels and all of his books, I think, you know, it's just
which
as writing.
Like
for example, one thing that I mentioned time and time again on this podcast is that if there is a threat, and to show how bad the threat is, you have to have the main character have a nightmare. And he does. He two or three points. And, you know, I thought you were saying that, you know, with this Fal character, you thought they were connected in some way or something like that. But no, he's just having nightmares. And you're like, oh, can he not? No, he had nightmares. Like twice. Twice he woke
Hosa,
up. Twice Hosa had. And it's like, really, just show the threat. Have him understand the threat. Don't just like, oh, he has a nightmare and he's going bad against it.
His threat is actually that he, like, because he's... I actually do understand that. Because he's a changer.
Yeah.
He has a problem of not being quite sure about his personality.
Yes, and I understand that. That's about the
that
fluid
is really,
personality.
It's a good one because I actually can imagine that if you have, like, if you can change your shape, at some point you think, what's actually my real, what is actually my real me?
Yeah. Another thing that I didn't like about it is what you said, the had-hads, and I've talked about the had-hads before, where you, the action starts, then you think, then you, how many had-hads are there in, searching, there are, quite a lot, actually, isn't there? Whoa, it keeps going. It keeps loading in,
This is a good thing about ebooks,
14 mentions. There's 14 had-hads. And had-hads I don't like because it's just... It kind of shows the hand of the writing a bit where you have somebody... You go, right, here's a chapter. Chapter 1 in time stops at week 3. Then we pick up at week 5 and we read about the character in week 5. But then he goes back in his mind and thinks about what's happened over weeks 2 and... three and 4... And then we keep reading about week 5. And then at the end of week 5, the chapter ends, and then we pick up on week 8. And then at the beginning of that, he thinks back what happened over, seven, and, you know. And this happens all the time, like these kind of told in the past tense about somebody thinking back about what has happened to them in the recent past, in the past tense. It's
and
like,
also, if you have something that occurs quite often, at some point, you recognize it.
Yeah.
And you read it through, you read through a story.
Grimace.
And then stop. You just like, head again. Head here. Again.
Well, I don't mind that technique done, but it kind of shows up the technique that at the start of most of these chapters, it starts off, and you go, we're starting off an action, but no, then we get in the filling backfilling of the stuff, and it felt clumsy in this book. But you only notice it when it's clumsy, and it did feel clumsy. Yeah. And then you get words like this. Someone this is just when I meant it, like someone commits suicide and he looks around and Hosa thinks, he goes, he hadn't been thinking of what Gao had just done to herself, but he looked around at the red stain on the angled wall and the collapsed shape of Gao's suit and thought it again. And you just, when you read something like that, you go, he's trying to be clever with this thing. He hadn't thought about it, but now he thinks about it again. But it's just the way that it's written is just so clumsy compared to some of his other writing there as well. I think that's about all of my notes here. And we've got cake and tea that's just arrived on the table. So anything else you want to say about this?
No, I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed the last bit where it's like, you have these little paragraphs where... Like it changes from
the viewpoints
to viewpoint, and it goes like here and there and here and there and there. It is like super,
But it's like that at the beginning of the book,
and it's really good.
When
up
until the point where he becomes crude, it's pretty much like halfway through, or when they go down to the temple of light.
Yeah.
At the end of the temple of light, you're like, yes, that's great. But in between the temple of light and them arriving.
In the tunnels.
Just a big bit where it's just flat. And you just want to skip over that bit, even though you
also
can't.
This is also why it took me quite a while to read through. Especially because like when you have these long explanations, the writing actually gets a bit more complicated. Because people don't talk. So it's not like the language changes a bit. And then it's difficult for me to read through because it is more like explaining things and stuff. And so that made it a bit a bit difficult for me.
Let me just show you what's actually going on here. He tips his hand right. Oh, I said just a nightmare. I obviously didn't make a note of it. But okay, we go right to the very end, just before the meet the author and the first chapter of Matter. I think it says here. He goes epilogue, blah blah blah. I met this thing, and they get onto this GSV, and the GSV. Well, what's the GSV called? The GSV is using the mind that was recovered, and he says, "Oh yes, I'm called. You know, what are you called? I am the Borahorse of Gorbachev." And no, that's not a thing. This is right at the very end. The ship's mind is recovered. The ship's mind names himself after Borahorse of Gorbachev. Goes, that's a weird name. How did you end up calling yourself that? The remote drone, which is the remote drone of the ship's mind, dipped one front corner slightly. Its equivalent of a shrug. It's a long story. Gemishin Fu shrugged. I like long stories. And you realize, oh, this whole thing, like he did with Player of Games, how the whole thing is told from the point of view of, well, it's one of the drones, but it's saying, oh, well, you don't know who I am, but I'm in the story. Yeah. Guess who I am, dear reader? And in the end, you think, ah, this is told by a ship's mind that likes long stories.
Yeah.
And you just think, oh.
I don't know if he now spoils.
Oh, no. He's saying it's a long story, and the other woman, actually. Yeah, so she was like, I like long stories, but wouldn't this story have been much better where if he said, if he dipped one front of its corner slightly, it's equivalent to a shrug. It's a long story. Gemishin Fug shrugged. I don't like that long of stories. Just get to the main point. Like, wouldn't it have been a much better novel if that was the last line, rather than, I like long stories. It would have been a much better novel if it had been like, I like compact stories. But then again, that's what we want. We wanted this story compacted down and it's slightly streamlined, because the middle part does drag. So, go star rate, stop eating the cake, and what's your star rating then for this one? How do you think it did? I was going to give this 3.5 stars, and I did it on Goodreads, like 4 stars, but I think I'm going to have to like knock it down to 3 stars, because I think it's, I don't want to call it 4 stars, because I kind of want to save that 4 stars for other culture books, because I think most culture books are 4 stars. There's a few which are 5 stars, a lot of them are 4 stars, but there's a few novels which I think are 3 stars, and I think this is one of the weakest books. I think there's this one and maybe Matter, which are two of the weaker books in this series. So I kind of want to differentiate between them and the other good stories, like, you know, like Surface Detail, or, you know, these are the ones. So I'm going to do that.
I gave it, in the end, I gave it 3 stars on Goodreads. And I saw, I'm one of the not many people who gave it 3 stars of the friends, of the listeners. But I think 3 stars is okay, because it's like, it has really good parts and it has really weak parts for me. And it's a nice book. I enjoyed reading it, but it wasn't, like, overall super enjoyable.
It's got a 3.82 rating on Goodreads in total, and let me just look, it's just loading. It's just loading the and friends reviews, which my friends are pretty much all listeners to the SFBRP. So a lot of them give it, quite a few give it 3 stars, quite 4 or 5 stars, but the average there is 3.64. So I think me giving it a 3.5 rating is a pretty average review. You're going to give it a 3-star rating.
Yep.
So I think together it'll be a 3.25-star rating.
Okay.
Between the two of us. So in that case, I will edit my review on goodreads.com and give it 3 stars there rather than the 4 stars that I thought I was going to do there. So, anything else you want to say, or should we just wrap it up there?
Yeah.
Next book that we're going to do is Accession, which is sometimes it's slightly complicated to read, but I think it's a lot easier to do it as an ebook rather than as an audiobook, because there's lots of conversations between ships. This is what I remember. And reading those, like reading them in an ebook or paper book where actually you can see the conversation. This ship says that, then ship says that. So we'll definitely do that as an ebook, like this one was an ebook.
You need to say goodbye to my dad.
Oh, is he going? No, let's just finish up here. Let's just say you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Luke Burge on Twitter. You can become my friend on goodreads.com, or Juliana's friend as well. Juliana Kunzendorf, you can find her on there, and join in with the SFBRP listener group, and you can come in with a read along. Hopefully you're all reading along. Email me, luke@juggler.net. That's how you can get in contact. Otherwise, what else? That's it. That's normally what we say. You can help support the podcast by getting the Audible trial, even though this wasn't an audiobook. audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And that's it. Thanks a lot for listening.
Goodbye.
And I'll catch you next time.